Turning on the thing. I thought I'd give tonight a talk on a subject that Terrence brought up last week. I was giving a talk last week on working with others without going crazy, practicing balance, equanimity, where to draw the line in our relationship with others. And if you missed that, and that sounds like the kind of talk you'd actually love to hear, all the talks for the last year have been put up on dharmapunks.podbean.com, or you can just look up Dharma Punks New York City, and it'll come up on Google. So this week, last week, Taryn shared about the importance in his practice of listening when others are suffering, which is a subject very dear to my heart. When it comes to giving a talk on listening, there are actually surprisingly few talks I found on the web. Generally, for each new topic I give, I check in with one of the monks that I've studied with over the years, and I'll listen to what they've taught on the subject just to make sure that I'm staying firmly within the Dhamma, and I've been practicing for many, many years, but it's important to check one's thought against the masters. But I actually didn't find very many talks on listening. It's perhaps because talking about listening is sort of a... it's a paradoxical endeavor at best. Now, when one gives a talk about listening, there's a couple of different things that I could talk about that I'm not. I'll just give a brief summary of them, because listening is actually a topic in the Buddhist teachings that does come up quite a bit. It often comes up under restraint of the senses. The Buddha talked about one of the things we practice in meditation is learning how to not be held hostage by our senses. In other words, sometimes in life when we're surrounded by very stressful sounds, it's very much in human nature to try to push away the things we don't like. But that action of trying to push away something we don't like actually draws our attention more to it. If you've ever tried to not think a thought, you'll know how successful that is. It doesn't work. You can't. If I said, don't think about white bears, you're going to think about white bears. So it's the idea that we can push anything away that's in our sensory realm is a fallacy. So part of Buddhist practice, spiritual practice, is to learn how to be with things without needing to react. And that's one of the things we develop, we cultivate in meditation. Learning to be with subtle amounts of pain and sounds in the world without needing to react, without needing to push it away, add a story, or cling to it. And the Buddha talked about how important it is to develop restraint of the senses during one's spiritual practice so that we won't run around constantly needing to find the perfect environment for us to be peaceful. If we have no ability to tolerate slight inconveniences and sounds and sights and smells and tactile sensations, we're going to find much of life deeply unpleasant and impossible to relax, because there are a lot of unpleasant sensations out there. So meditation is a time when you can actively cultivate the skill of being around uncomfortable sounds, uncomfortable smells, uncomfortable, probably tonight would be a good example, I'm sure. But, developing the skill of being able to switch one's awareness from things that cause stress back into the body and to work with the breath to find places in the body that are comfortable. This restraint of the senses is a very, very common topic that the Buddha talked about throughout the Pali Canon. But I'm not going to talk about that. That was my whole spiel on that form of listening. And another form of listening is listening to the Dhamma. And the Buddha talked a lot about how to listen to the Dhamma when it's being shared, like tonight. And basically, I probably left it somewhere. The Buddha had a number of teachings, and they boiled down to two things. When we're listening to the Dhamma, the most important thing is to be calm and to try to focus one's intention so that we can hear enough of the thoughts that we can then go out into life and practice and see if what you hear is true. The Buddha didn't want you to believe anything that you hear. Don't simply believe anything they say. It's the whole practice of Buddhism is to put things into effect and see if they really work for you. Don't believe anything I say. Try it out. See what works. See if it's true. So part of listening to the Dhamma is simply getting calm enough that we're not distracted, that we're not thinking about other thoughts or what's going on in the day, so that we can hear enough of the ideas that when we experience difficulties in life, we can try out some of the spiritual tools that you hear in any Buddhist setting and see if they work out and see which tools work for you. Not all Buddhist tools work for everybody all the time. That's why it's important to pick up as many spiritual tools. Why, for example, the Buddha gave a talk like 5 different ways of getting rid of obsessive thoughts, which is a talk I give quite frequently. If the Buddha just gave one way to get rid of obsessive thoughts, a lot of us would be screwed because that one way probably wouldn't work for everybody. So most of the Buddha's teachings are lists and lists and lists of so many different ways to end suffering and stress. And that's generally what I talk about, all the lists of ways to stop suffering and stop being stressed out. But tonight I'm going to talk about how to listen as a way to be helpful, as a way to promote healing. And nothing ever works one way. When we listen and when we listen to help someone, to help provide a sense of support, we actually build up a sense of positive esteem for ourselves. We feel connected. In fact, there's a lot of wonderful things that listening does that it doesn't get credit for. Part of the human mind is that we often carry around stories about how different we are, how unique, how unusual our stresses are, how all the problems I have nobody else has ever had, or they don't really quite have in the same way I do, or my feelings are different entirely, or I'm just completely unique. And listening to another human being while they're suffering, it could be a person we're in a relationship who's had a hard day at work. It could be an elderly relative who's sick or old or infirm. It could be a colleague who's stressed out. It could be a friend who's been dumped from a relationship. We're exposed to suffering and stress quite frequently in life. And there's so many opportunities, again, to build up a sense of esteem as ourselves, as being part of a useful spiritual practice, people who can help others. And it's incredibly important to breaking down those feelings of, I'm different. Nobody has ever suffered like I have, or I'm a real victim, or nobody knows what it's like to go through a divorce or breakup or, a stressful job. The more we listen, the more we connect, and the more we see how truly universal most of the human experience really is. And we only really get that by really hearing. We don't get it intellectually. You can't think yourself into realizing that you're not unique, you're not separate, you're not alone. You really have to hear it. So it's a very valuable spiritual practice, yet it's also a very, very difficult one. I think that there's something very ingrained deeply in the mind, probably in the amygdala, which is a part of the oldest part of the brain, the limbic system, that really develops a lot of stress when we're around suffering. We feel if we're around somebody who's sick or someone who's ailing or emotionally really tangled up, somebody who's deeply, deeply upset, we feel if we're around them that somehow their suffering could either spread to us or we're somehow vulnerable when we leave ourselves open and we expose ourselves to it. I've spent many, many years in hospital settings. My mom developed MS when I was around 20 and spent well over a decade slowly dying of it. I spent at least 14 years in different hospitals, hospices, and assisted living facilities with her. And then the moment she... and then my dad spent the last number of years of his life. And I got very interested in it, having to spend so many years of my life visiting an ailing parent. I actually started hanging out and talking with a lot of the hospice workers there. And I got interested in hospice work, and I started talking with my friend Chodo, who runs Zen Care, and we started talking about that, and I became affiliated with his organization, which trains people to do hospice work. And so I'm trying to share tonight some of the tools that I've learned there and in other settings of being a long-time sober person. I've, over many, many, many years, sponsored people, which involves a lot of listening to a lot of suffering, and just being part of a real relationship, and being a brother, and being a human being requires developing the skill. And believe me, I'm working on this skill all the time. One of the downsides to my naturally exuberant blabathon personality is I have that. That natural, like, sort of, I've been a member of a spiritual path for a long time, and I really, really believe that this works. It's worked in my life and in the life of a lot of people, and there's this desire when you hear suffering to jump in and say, I know what's wrong! And I know a guy who I've been friendly with for a long time who's a Buddhist teacher. I'm not going to name his name, so I'm going to be slightly critical. He's very, very talented, but when people share, when it's time to share, he cuts everybody off. The moment he knows what they're sharing about, he jumps right in with the solution. And it's taken me a lot of time, because over the years of spiritual practice, and especially teaching, to just be present and allow somebody to completely share what's going on without cutting them off, giving them a safe space to open and to talk about what they've been experiencing. There's an amazing series of psychological studies that were done by a group of psychologists called Bowlby and Ainsworth, Mary Ainsworth. And they did a bunch of clinical studies in what was called attachment theory. And the basic idea is that in the pre-verbal phases of a child's development, when basically we're babies, you can actually predict very accurately a lot of the interpersonal skills that a person will develop just by watching their attachment to their mothers as infants. You watch a baby, and if a baby forms what's known as secure attachment with the mother, you can pretty much accurately say, well, that baby's going to grow up and actually be able to be in solid, secure relationships. But if the relationship between the baby and the mother is insecure, where the baby feels needing to constantly cling onto the mother, because if the mother loses attention, doesn't pay attention to the baby, starts looking away and is easily distracted, those babies very often grow up to be people who find it very difficult and challenging to be in lasting, secure relationships. They see with babies that are in secure relationships that they feel safe to explore and be around other people, because they know that the mother is attentive and there and watching them and giving them visual signs of that they're being watched. And really, they found with clinical studies that what people are looking for in most healing situations, therapeutic, is we're looking for someone to see us, to really see us. We're not so much looking for somebody to jump in, some weird bearded tattooed guy, you know, sitting in the front to tell us what the solution is. We really want deeply someone to listen and hear us. Someone to emotion, what's known as emotionally mirror us, which is to meet our gaze and to give us a facial expression that is appropriate for what we're saying. There's nothing worse than when you go into a healing situation, you're talking about you're stressed out and the person is smiling at you with a big, you know, idiotic smile. Like, it's great that you're, you know, and I'm the enlightened person and I know, you know, I can, you know, I know what a silly willy you are, and as soon as I give you the Dhamma, you'll be... No, you know, meet somebody with an appropriate gaze. The most important things, in fact, that happen when I've been sitting with... when I've been in anything from a hospice situation to a being with a sponsee to a person that I'm counseling through Dhammapuns is simply to meet the gaze, to be present, to nod, and to ask questions rather than to, you know, do what I do here in Dhamma Talks, which is to try to give answers. It's very important to develop the skill of asking really how somebody is, to find out where they're at, to see how they're doing navigating through their anxieties and through their fears, through their difficulties. If I do, very often, I try to also rephrase what I think they're saying, what their feelings are. So if somebody is talking and they've paused, then I'll I hear that they're not communicating anymore, that they're stuck, I'll say something like, so what I hear you saying is that you're very frustrated and you're feeling very, cornered, boxed in. Just try to rephrase the feelings rather than to immediately jump in and say, for example, oh, I know what that's like. Yeah, I've been there. I've been through. I've been fired. I've been dumped. I know what it's like. The problem with saying that is, though, it seems when we're sharing, like when we immediately say, oh, I know what that's like, it seems very often like it can be skillful, but actually everybody reacts very differently, and no two people's experiences, while we all share so much in common, no two people's experiences are exactly the same. So if we say, oh, I know what that's like, it's a form of belittling, and it's almost invariably said too early, before we really know what's going on. So it's better to simply attempt re-verbalizing what you think you hear them saying, what their feelings are, and just ask, so are you feeling frustrated, frightened, scared? Is that what I hear you saying? And just really get to the point where they feel very, that you've understood what the feelings truly are. That, to me, creates some of the most powerful early bonds that happen during listening. Now, I've brought down some, over the years, what I've learned is things to avoid. The first is avoiding any distractions, which are to put aside my stories, my, all, you know, well, I know your life is tough, but my life is fucking tough, too. So this temptation to go off into my story, my life, to try to use hearing as an opportunity to literally put my story down. And very often that can make my problems, my challenges in life, actually, when I really hear what's going on with someone else, they not only make me feel less alone, but sometimes, my God, other people's challenges are far more fucked up than mine. So they can make you feel, oh, shit, I was worried about this, and my friend here's got a lot more going on their plate than I do. So put aside the distractions, and that means really, for those of us in the sort of connected world, to turn this thing off, really. If you're with a friend, I don't care if you're the most important human being in the world, give that conversation the dignity of literally putting your phone on vibrate for a while and not answering and not looking at your texts. You may think that the texts are the most important things in the world, but try to be present with the person. Try to really hear what's happening. I try to immediately, all the time, also at the very beginning and throughout, I try to get as physically comfortable working with my breath, so that it's very difficult to listen to somebody's stress and someone's suffering. And almost invariably, when I do, this little subtle signs of tension and wanting it all to go away will start to arise. No matter how helpful I want to be, this underlying sense of, oh, please stop, will like arise. And so it's very important to work with the breath, to keep your body as relaxed and open and peaceful as you can while you're listening. Obstacles. I believe it's important to get as close as you can without being claustrophobic. If you're sitting separated by a desk or far away, or, you know, you've got something in between you and them, like a computer, that your eyes are looking towards, that's not going to work. It's very important to be in an environment at least close enough. Don't sit across from a table, sit adjacent. You know, try to get to a place where there's a lot of proximity, but again, not creepily so. Not like that Seinfeld close talker thing. That's sort of bad. That's wrong. Don't do that. Pity. Avoid pity at all costs. There's one thing to say, I'm sorry that things have turned out this way. That can be skillful, but oh, I'm so sorry for you. You know, oh, you poor thing, you know, how are you ever going to... This kind of pity, this looking down is not... You want to bond. A sense of, if you can't bond, just look and give the appropriate facial responses. But try to not say things that indicate that we're up here and they're down there. We're trying to say things that make us, that reinforce that we understand how they feel. So again, restating feelings, trying to restate how you think they're, what you hear them saying is very powerful, as opposed to constantly jumping in and saying, oh, you poor thing. It's important, it's extremely important to not judge under any conditions. What I mean by this is everybody responds to things in life very, very differently. I've seen people who've gone out with somebody for a week, and when they go through the breakup, they fall apart. And there's a part of the brain that goes, what the fuck? You were going out with her for a week. Oh my God. Why are you floored? But really what's going on is they've attached much earlier rejections, much earlier experiences in their life where they've been shunted aside, cast aside, rejected, and they've attached it to this new experience. So they're really actually just waiting to be given the opportunity to share about it so that they can open up to the older feelings. On the other hand, it's important not to try to also change what somebody is feeling ever. Never try to get somebody to minimize their feelings, like, oh, well, try to pull yourself together for your children. Try to pull yourself together for your, you know, work, you know. Just try to be a good soldier, go in there, and then when you go home, you can fall apart. But this idea that we're going to try to help somebody mask their feelings is never, ever, ever a good solution. Again, we're trying to use this time to give them a safe place where they can share, and that's really where the healing is going to happen. But if we immediately give them the agenda of changing how they feel without first really hearing it, giving it a safe place, we're not doing anybody any favors. Never, in my experience, is a good idea to try to minimize feelings or try to get people to change or mask anything. I try to, when it does come to, I try to hold back the, when you do think you know a solution, you do think you have an idea that could help. Thankfully, a lot of people have thought very good of Dharmapunks and other Buddhist places, and almost all the time the way people wind up here is because a friend said, hey, well, maybe you might want to come to Dharmapunks. So that's a form of advice. But when we say that, it's important to really wait to, you really are certain that they've gotten off their chest the feelings, what they need to share, that you really heard what they want to express. And then really, if it's whatever you're going to advise, keep the advice as simple as you humanly can. Because most of the time, in my experience, when someone is suffering, their mind is filled with thoughts about how bad it is, how bad it's going to turn out, how they're different, how they fucked up, how things are never going to be the same, how they're just filled with thoughts. And if you try to cram in more, you're just going to have that thought lost in the morass. So keep it as simple as humanly possible. All I get, you know, I hear that you're sad, you feel alone, and if you want, you can come with me to a Dharmapunks meeting. You could come, we could go out to dinner, we could, whatever you think is this will be helpful. But just keep it really simple and offer it up, not as you have to do this, but that it's something simply as an offering. So, and finally, avoid any temptation to promise rosy future outcomes. I've been in hospital situations where people were literally dying, literally a few feet away, and you see them surrounded by the family, and there's still family members who, when this person is clearly knows that they're in very late life stages, you'll still see family members going, oh, you know, grandma, you'll pull through this. You'll live to be 100. We have this desire to give reassurance as if reassurance is always skillful. And in hearing and listening and being present, giving false reassurances almost never works. It's so tempting, and I hear myself wanting to do it time and time again. Well, I'm sure you'll be okay. I'm sure this job, which sucks, it'll pass. I'm sure that you'll get over this. I'm sure you'll be fine, whatever. But it's really important to really avoid that, because we really don't know how anybody's going to be. We don't know how we're going to be. It's more important to just bond over the feelings. Restate what you hear, ask questions, listen, give facial responses, meet someone's gaze, be present, let them know you're there, and don't feel you need to say anything when you don't have anything to say. Just your being present is enough. So that's all really my years of experience have to offer. I know there's a lot of people here who have a lot of experience with this, so I'm hoping that anyone with any experience in helping, or just has any experience at all about listening, would share, so that we can hear from you and gain from your wisdom. So thanks for listening.